Since 1988, Hamas has made well over a dozen attempts to make peace with Israel, all totally ignored. In 2008, Yuval Diskin, the head of Shin Bet, the Israeli security agency, confirmed that Hamas was willing to accept a long-term ceasefire on the 1967 borders. And by long-term, he was talking 40, 50 years. That same year, the Strategic Studies Institute of the U.S. Army War College wrote that Hamas had, quote, accepted the notion of a limited area for a Palestinian state and would recognize Israel in a de facto manner, end of quote. Israel has never recognized the Palestinian people or their right to a state. On June 3rd, 2009, Hamas sent President Obama a letter outlining its commitment to pursue, without preconditions, a just resolution within the guidelines set by the International Court of Justice, the United Nations, and human rights organizations. That same year, in 2009, Jimmy Carter wrote that Hamas, quote, would accept any agreement if it submitted to a referendum in the West Bank and Gaza, and the Palestinian people approve it. That means they would accept Israel's right to exist if that's in the agreement. Israel has never accepted the Palestinian right to exist. In fact, it doesn't want them to exist at all. Former National Security Advisor and former head of Mossad, Ephraim Halevi, said the U.S. and Israel could strengthen Hamas's moderate wing and engage them in a peace process. They didn't. Halevi also said, quote, if Israel's goal were to remove the threat of rockets from the residents of southern Israel, opening the border crossings would have ensured such quiet for a generation, end of quote. Israel's government refused to open the crossing. Obviously, they're not so interested in peace, in quiet for a generation. They have other goals in mind. Speaking of rockets, in the 9 years ending on December 31st, 2008, during Operation Cast Lead, Gazan groups fired a total of 8,088 rockets into Israel. That's on the basis of a right-wing Israeli think tank. Now compare those figures, 8,088, to the nine-month period, one-twelfth the length of time, 9 months, not 9 years, to the nine-month period ending in June 2006, during which Israel fired 7,700 far more deadly rockets into Gaza. I want to mention something. When I was in Sderot, in 2010, Sderot is one of the towns that was attacked on October 7th. It's like a mile from the Gaza border. I saw lots of rockets that had been shot from Gaza. I saw lots of depressions in the ground where they landed. I would estimate that if I were 10 feet away from a rocket landing, I wouldn't have been hurt, or maybe injured a little by flying debris. Israel's rockets have a kill radius of up to 150 meters. That's almost 500 feet versus 10 feet, okay? So there's a huge difference between the rockets Israel launches against Gaza and the rockets that Hamas launches against Israel. A few months ago, the House of Representatives passed Resolution 894, which equates anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. Historically, some of the staunchest Zionists were anti-Semites who wanted to rid their country of Jews. And many of the staunchest anti-Zionists were religious Jews who considered a nationalist movement to create a Jewish nation heresy to the Torah, which says that only God, through the Moshiach, or Messiah, can establish a Jewish state. Pro-Israelis who equate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism presume that you're not an anti-Semite if you deny documented history, but you are one if you accept documented history. You're not an anti-Semite if you defend Israel's contempt for international law, but you are one if you believe in international law. And you're not an anti-Semite if you rationalize Israel's cruelty towards the Palestinian people, but you are one if you have compassion for the Palestinian people, in which case all Palestinians are anti-Semites. Doesn't this narcissistic reasoning characterize the Jewish people as inhumane? But such a characterization would itself be considered anti-Semitic. In other words, the proof you're not an anti-Semite proves that you are an anti-Semite. This is the dualistic mind infected with existential fear and confusion. I want to briefly mention two of the most common arguments Israeli loyalists make to justify Israel's position and stance against the Palestinians. The first is the 1947 UN partition plan, which unilaterally took 56% of Palestine from the Palestinian people and gave it to Israel, gave 43% with only 20% of the coastline to the Palestinian people, and the remaining 1%, Jerusalem and Bethlehem, was placed in a corpus separatum to be administered by the United Nations. The argument that Israeli loyalists make is that Jewish acceptance and Palestinian rejection of partition proves the Jewish side has always wanted peace and the Palestinian side has never wanted peace. Therefore, the Palestinians are to blame for this problem. It's their fault they live under occupation. This ridiculous argument imagines that Israel would have been content with 56% of Palestine and no Jerusalem when Israel has never been content with the 78% of Palestine it has controlled since 1949. Moreover, a Jewish state under partition would have had a 49% plus Palestinian minority that would quickly have become a majority. It is utterly naive to think that Israel would have accepted such an outcome. And in fact, David Ben-Gurion, Israel's founding father, pledged to his political party that the borders established by partition were not permanent. And he said, after we become a strong force as the result of the creation of a state, we shall abolish partition and expand into the whole of Palestine, end of quote. It wasn't just Ben-Gurion. Chaim Weizmann, who was Israel's first president, who was the man most responsible for the Balfour Declaration in 1917, in which Israel announced that the Jews could have a homeland. Chaim Weizmann said before the partition plan was passed, and this was going on for more than a decade, where the Jewish agency in Palestine was lobbying for a partition plan and for a state of Israel. Chaim Weizmann said, the Jews would be fools not to take a piece of land the size of a tablecloth. Why? Because they knew they were going to expand into the whole of Palestine. Taking all this into account, in March 1948, 2 months before Israel became a state, the U.S. State Department warned, the Jews will be the actual aggressors against the Arabs. However, the Jews will claim that they are merely defending themselves. In the event of such Arab outside aid, the Jews will come running to the Security Council with the claim that their state is the object of armed aggression and will use every means to obscure the fact that it is their own armed aggression against the Arabs inside which is the cause of Arab counterattack. End of quote. The second argument I very briefly am going to go over is Palestinian rejection of Israel's alleged generous offer at the 2000 Camp David Peace Summit. Well, if Israel's offer was so generous, why did Israel's chief negotiator, Shlomo Ben-Ami, say, quote, the concessions offered by Israel fell far short of even modest Palestinian explanations. And he also said, if I were a Palestinian, I would have rejected Camp David as well, end of quote. Moreover, if Israel was really interested in peace, why has it totally ignored the Arab Peace Initiative, which was first introduced in 1988, has been on the table since 2002, was reiterated in 2012, and Israel has never had a word to say about it? That peace initiative provides security guarantees for all the states in the regions. It would end the Arab-Israeli conflict, and it would normalize relations between Israel and every Muslim country on earth, all 50 of them. So why is it that in the name of peace, so many people rationalize Israel's refusal to make peace? Why in the name of justice do so many people rationalize Israel's unjust policies? Why do they protect Israel from accountability for its crimes and give it the means to perpetrate those crimes? Are they evil? Or are they terrified of the truth? But it is not because they are evil. It is because in their existential fear of inquiring into their presumed identities, they are confused and they suffer deeply. even though they are unconscious to their own suffering. This is why I say that the real enemy is the unexamined mind that projects its suffering onto the other and then blames and scapegoats the other for its suffering. Years ago, an old man in Gaza stood on a corner holding a placard. I always cry when I read this, on which were written these words: "You take my water, burn my olive trees, destroy my house, take my job, steal my land, imprison my father, kill my mother, bombard my country, starve us all, humiliate us all, but I am to blame. I shot a rocket back." End of quote. I want to end with a short quiz. I'm going to read a quote that includes the word Yid. For those who don't know, the word Yid is a derogatory name for a Jew. And you're going to guess who said this quote. Now, I'm going to give you a hint. The person I'm quoting was male and lived and died in the first half of the 20th century and was extremely well known to the worldwide Jewish community. Here's the quote. "Yid is anti-Zionist. We have known him for a long time. And just merely to look at him, let alone approach or, heaven forbid, touch him, was enough to make us feel sick. The Yid is a hideous distortion of the human character, something unspeakably low and repulsive. The Yid is the curse of the Jews. Watch out, Yid." End of quote. Any guesses? No, but I'll give you another hint. This person who made this quote, his birthday is celebrated as a national holiday in Israel. Any other guesses? Theodor Herzl. Theodor Herzl, the founder of political Zionism. He was an atheist who detested religious Jews. He did not circumcise his son. He even went to the Pope and said, "If you help me get a piece of land for the Jewish people, I'll convert them to Roman Catholicism." Okay, most of the Zionists were not religious. Now there are religious Zionists like Bezalel Smotrich, for example, who's the one of the coalition members to Netanyahu. He's religious Zionist. And I think Ben-Gavir, who's in charge of security, he may be religious Zionist, or maybe he calls himself just a formal Zionist, but he's related. They're both religious. Okay, that ends the talk. Does anybody have any questions?
I deeply appreciate the description of your spiritual awakening. What would you propose to do as a first step toward transforming this situation? What else?
Okay, first of all, as I mentioned and strongly implied, we're not going to reach the people who are strongly identified with Israel. We need to speak to people on the fence, okay? People on the fence, when they hear a logical, intelligent, sane, humane argument, they're going to see what's real. But the people who are like I was at one time, forget it. You're not going to reach them. To give you an example, I'm still in touch with many Jewish people I grew up with, who I went to even nursery school with. But almost all of them will not pick up a book. They will not even read my book, and they think they know more than I know, even though they know they've never studied the issue, and I have. And they know that I'm smarter than them, and always was. They know it. Okay? So I can't even reach them. Okay, so first of all, lobbies. We got to get rid of these lobbies. The billions of dollars that goes into perverting the system, the political system in the United States, is obscene. The fact that AIPAC is not even listed as an agent of a foreign country is also obscene. But they, in my opinion, any dark money should be eliminated, which means Reverse Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision that the Republicans supported. We've got to get rid of these lobbies and purify the political system. If this were 1938 Germany, and there was an AGPAC, American-German Public Affairs Committee, most of our congressmen in Biden and Blinken would be supporting Adolf Hitler. When I say ethnically cleansed, for most people in Israel who support what Israel is doing, which is over, this is something like 98% supported Israel's invasion of Gaza, 68% right now do not want Israel allowing humanitarian aid in the country. They want to starve these people to death. Almost 60% think Israel has been going too easy on the Palestinians since they attacked, okay? Education is very important, but again, we see in this country how the Republicans in the red states are trying to prevent really, you can't even read Huckleberry Finn in school. You can't read To Kill a Mockingbird. They're really trying to maintain the myths, the myth of the Lost Cause, for example, in the South. They don't want their children growing up thinking that Southerners, Southern whites, supported slavery and that the Civil War was a battle to end slavery. They want people to think that the Civil War, that the South's participation in the Civil War was a noble battle for states' rights. Okay, so they're training, just like they do in Israel, they are training their children to not be in touch with their humanity and to separate the world into us against them. That is what they do in Israel. And they do it so severely. I have seen numerous videos online of Israeli soldiers, young Israeli soldiers, mostly in their 20s, bragging, I killed 22 children and I'm going to kill more. And then the reporter was saying, you're a monster. And it didn't faze him at all. He was so happy that he had killed all these cockroaches. Because Israel has trained its people to think of the Palestinians as subhuman. The language its leaders have used. I mentioned Rafael Eitan, Israel's longest-serving chief of staff, who said, if the Palestinians had done to us what we did to them, we would never make peace. Okay, so I mention him because he used to refer to Palestinians as cockroaches. Other prominent Israelis, generals and politicians have called them beasts walking on two legs, human animals, crocodiles, all kinds of horrible things. They really dehumanize them. Anyway, so we've got to start with education. Now, I'm not particularly confident that this is ever going to get any better. I see Israel maybe moving towards using a nuclear weapon against Iran in the future. And I see this world becoming so polarized that that we're going to destroy ourselves. Maybe we're going to destroy ourselves just through the environment. But all I can say is I don't do this because I think I'm going to have success promoting the cause I support. I do it because it's the right thing to do. And maybe in some time, what I do, what all of us do, will somehow reverberate throughout history and have some kind of effect in the future.
Even if we take out the red state folks like DeSantis who are trying to purify the university system there, we have the elite universities, Ivy League and elsewhere, where right after October 7th, the billionaires that were funding their schools were pulling their money out, and then Congress eventually called in the presidents of the universities. And now, Columbia, Harvard, University of Southern California are taking the lead in silencing all protest. And I mean, it's not just that it's not an educationally conducive environment. They're crushing independent thinking in the universities. How do we move past that?
That's a hard question to answer because a lot of the funding comes from the money that the donors bequeath. And a lot of the donors are Jewish. And I have always said that when someone's identity, Jewish or not, but when someone's mortal identity is threatened, there is nothing they will not do to defend themselves, to shut you up, if even just the words. When I criticize Israel and I make an argument against Israel to my friends or my relatives, which I don't do anymore, it's a waste of time. But if I do that, they feel so threatened. They're not that conscious of how they feel deep within. But they are so threatened because when I criticize Israel, as I say, their presumed identity is fused with Israel. Israel as a safe haven for the Jewish people, as the innocent nation that represents Jews, is part of their identity. So when I challenge them, it's as if they're facing a mortal threat. They're about to die because their belief is part of how they define themselves. If that belief is wrong, that is a form of death. That is why so many people, not just with the Israel-Palestine issue, with all kinds of issues, so many people would rather send their children to war, to kill or be killed, than inquire into their presumed identities or into the beliefs and images that constitute their presumed identities.
When you're talking to your relatives and such, and you're trying to convince them and argue or make points, do you listen to their views? In other words, don't express your view.
Right.
Don't put your view in there, make your points, and look for things to say, but listen and empathize and
no.
come. Oh, well, well then you are not communicating with them.
That's right.
Then you have a wall.
Oh, that's true.
Yes.
It is very difficult, especially with family, especially with my identical twin brother, who is an Orthodox Jew. Okay, there is no way of getting through to him. In my first book, there is a chapter on my dialogue with my twin brother. Okay?
Okay.
Now look, some people you just can't reach. When my nephew calls me up, he goes, "Hi Richie, how you doing? Let's not talk about Israel Palestine." And so I don't. I honor his wishes. I'd rather have peace in the family. It's a very difficult thing.
Oh, I know.
Someone here mentioned nonviolent communication. Let me just say, I once attended a 10-day retreat with Marshall Rosenberg, the founder of nonviolent communication. Marshall was there with his top trainers, the ones who had started with him from the very beginning. They had arguments, and they couldn't solve their own arguments. Now, Marshall, and I'm telling you,
that whole ego thing.
Of course.
Because we don't get what we want. So
the ego is persistent. The ego lives to preserve itself, aggrandize itself, and validate itself.
Right.
There is no way that you can come from the ego and really solve anything. It's such a spiritual practice to surrender the ego. And sometimes you can do it, sometimes you can't. If you're really triggered, as Marshall would say, you need to give yourself a lot of self-empathy before you can speak to that person. I want to give someone else a chance to ask a question. Yes, ma'am.
Let's go way back, 1,000 or whatever, B.C. Jews have been treated badly. And I'm wondering, where does this psychology come from?
Well,
what started it?
Well, the fact that Jews have been treated badly is a part of the reason why the Jews felt they needed a state of their own.
I understand.
But I have to clarify something. As I mentioned about Herzl being totally anti-religious, Zionism was a movement that very few Jews subscribed to. And in fact, there would not even be an Israel if not for the fact that the Zionist organization blocked FDR's plan in 1944 to take in, between the United States and Western Europe, 100% of Holocaust survivors. The Zionist organization blocked it. And there was a poll taken at Dachau concentration camp after the war ended. Only 15% of the Dachau survivors said they wanted to go to Palestine. In the 1920s, more Jews emigrated from Palestine than emigrated into Palestine. So Zionism needed real deceit in order to create enough of a demographic of Jews in Palestine to create a state. And that's what they did. They blocked FDR's plan. So, yes, it's part of the Jewish psyche, you could say. People who are brought up with these stories that the Arabs have always hated Jews. It's part of their psyche about the having to destroy the Amalekites and the Jews had to fight all these different tribes. It's in the, you know, in the Old Testament. But that's no excuse for not examining your own thoughts. It's no excuse to recognize that before you're a Jew or a Christian or a Muslim, you are a human being, and you share a common humanity.
You were just listening to Richard Forer on psycho-spiritual roots of the Israel-Palestinian tragedy. He spoke in Colorado Springs in late April. Richard Forer is the author of Wake Up and Reclaim Your Humanity on the tragedy of Israel-Palestine. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Arundhati Roy, Ralph Nader, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Richard Forer on the psycho-spiritual roots of the Israel-Palestinian tragedy, and for his book, Wake Up and Reclaim Your Humanity, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. www.rhodesonline.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to the Colorado Springs Justice and Peace Commission. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Bilal Abu Amne, My Tormented Heart.
This is Jesse Brown, the host of CanadaLand, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
This is